And good morning, and thanks for tuning in to 88.5 KRFY. This is the morning show, and we are live in the studios downtown here at the Panhandle Community Radio. And as I said, this is the morning show, and I'm Susie Prez, one of the co-hosts.
And I'm your co-host over here, Susie, Chris Bessler. How are you this morning?
I'm fine. Good morning, Chris. And how are you?
I'm well. I'm okay. I can't hardly not be well with such beautiful weather.
I know. I was just feeling how wonderful it felt last night out watering the garden. It was like paradise.
Was the moon up yet? Yep. We've been getting some beautiful moons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was just coming up. Yeah. So, and what do we have planned for today?
Well, we have a great show today. We are going to be talking with Kenneth Cloak. He's a part-time resident of Hope, but he's the founder of the Center for Dispute Resolution in California and also a co-founder of Mediators Beyond Borders. And Kenneth is giving a talk tomorrow. It's a community talk at the Columbia Bank Building about, it's called A Conversation About Conflict. And you see it right now. Ken, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for making it in this morning. And we have a lot to talk about. Conflict seems to be at the root of the national psyche right now, along with, of course, the conflicts we have every day in our lives, of everything from families, brothers and sisters, right up to homeowners associations, to communities, to the nation. And we're really interested to hear about what you have to say about conflict and how to constructive ways to resolve disputes. But first, Susie.
What would you like to hear?
I'd like to know a little bit more about what's in store for us weather-wise.
Okay, well, from the National Weather Service, pretty much what we've been experiencing, a little cooler, but we do get up to 90 degrees on Saturday with slight chance of sprinkles.
Oh, sprinkles.
Not rain, not showers, but sprinkles.
I actually wouldn't mind a little rain on my lawn right now.
I know. I'm not sure what they mean by sprinkles, but I guess hopefully we'll find out. Today, high of 83, low tonight, 51. I love the cool nights. High on Thursday, that's tomorrow, of 88, and low Thursday night, 53. There is a patchy smoke and then sunny. That's what they're saying.
Mm-hmm. But in other words, in a word, beautiful.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the good thing is over here, we're a little cooler. I know in Missoula, it's 100 degrees the next 3 days.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah. Yeah, it is hot over much of the country right now.
Right.
A few of the other things going on outside, as I mentioned earlier, we've been having some beautiful full moons this past week. The last quarter moon is Sunday. Also, you can see Mercury as the bright evening star all month. It's low in the skies, but if you see a real bright star out there, that's probably the planet Mercury. And we do have the sunrise now at 4:57 a.m. It'll be setting at 8:45 p.m. We're losing a little bit of daylight now as we're past the summer solstice, but we still have those glorious long days of summer. Lake is at full pool, 2062.24 feet. It should be staying right there. And on the stream flow side of things, the Moye River is down low, too low to actually do a whitewater run on now. It's at 281 CFS. The Priest River is down as well. It's at 624 CFS, but there is actually a little whitewater run that could be had on the Priest River if you're into such a thing.
So when you say there's no whitewater run, but people are still floating it, but it's slower.
No.
No.
You can't get a raft down. It's too low now to
rocks.
Do rafts. Yeah. You can actually do an inner tube on the Moye. There's some sections that are pretty fun in an inner tube. Kind of a lot of dragon.
Mm-hmm.
But moving. On a hot summer day, it's pretty fun.
I want to let our listeners know also at 9 o'clock, right after Bird Notes, I will have an extra special morning show, Wednesday morning show interview with Gaia Swinford. She's from the Bonner County Gardeners Association because they have a garden tour coming up on Sunday. So after this show, stay with us. We'll have an extra special morning show interview at 9.
Yeah. And other things going on around town. It's the Northwest Wine Fest this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, up at Schweitzer. They have five different bands that are going to be playing, and 20 regional wineries are going to be pouring 80-plus wines. So if you enjoy wine, that would be a great event to go to. It's also a little cooler up there high up. It should be a beautiful weekend at Schweitzer for the Wine Fest. On Thursday, that's tomorrow, the festival at Sandpoint is having their annual art unveiling at Dover Bay. That's a really cool event to go to. And there's an event going on that actually starts today Sandpoint area seniors are having their estate sale. It's a big, kind of a huge garage sale. It's an important fundraiser for the senior center, and that's at the senior center in town. It's not starting today. It's starting Thursday, and that runs through Saturday. That's at the senior center.
I do know they're setting up, and there's tons of stuff over there. So yes. That starts tomorrow at, what time does it start? 9 a.m.
Yep. There you go. In the news, Senator Sean Keel announced Monday, that she is going to not be seeking re-election. Interesting historical fact about Sean is that she was the longest-serving female member of the legislature ever, and she was a co-chair of the Budget Appropriations Committee, which is one of the most important committees in the state because they control the purse strings. So it's unfortunate that Sean's decided not to seek re-election, but she served us so well over 20-plus years. Shout out. Thanks to Sean for your service.
Yep. Thank you, Sean. And a little anecdote with that. I remember when she first started running, she came over to the Waldorf School just because she wanted to know about education in our community. She really was seeking out information about what was going on in education. So I remember her as just a young person going in.
I consider her still pretty young.
Come on. She is.
And with that, let's get into today's topic. Again, we have with us Ken Cloak. He's a part-time resident of Hope, and he's also the founder of the Center for Dispute Resolution, a co-founder of Mediators Beyond Borders. He's giving a talk tomorrow. That's Thursday, 5:30 to 7 at the community room at Columbia Bank. And Ken, again, thank you for being here. Is it good to call you Ken or Kenneth? What do you prefer?
Whatever you like.
Well, there's no dispute there.
No okay. conflicts over that.
Okay. I'd like to hear a little bit about your background and what it is
sure.
that you do.
Great. Well, what I do is I work with people who are in conflict and try to help them figure out what the problem is and how they're going to get out of it, what they're going to do about it. So by background, I was trained as a lawyer. I worked as a judge for a period of time, but realized that none of that was going to be particularly helpful for people who have either ordinary types of disputes or people whose disputes really are not covered by the law in any way whatsoever. So the law has very little to say about what to do about children, how to have a good marriage. What do you do when your neighbor does something that you don't like? Any of those types of issues are ones that are difficult for people to handle using a legal framework. But then as a result of experience in conflict resolution, I realized there was a deeper problem. Every conflict that we experience because there are at least two truths. So if you have a mechanism for resolving the differences between those two truths, it says that only one of them is actually true. You've lost all the richness and complexity that comes out of combining those two truths together.
And I gotta guess it's sometimes hard to get to that point where you can combine two, polar opposite stands that people may hold when they have a conflict.
Sure. It's almost always difficult if you're the one who holds one of them. That's why you need a mediator who's outside both of those truths and can see the validity of both of them and then can look for creative ways of resolving them. Yeah. I have a way of thinking about this for myself, which is basically this. There are two ways of combining things. First, you can take hot water and cold water and mix them together and you get lukewarm water. That's basically compromise. But second, you can take water, mix flour and heat and create bread. So out of those two truths comes the possibility of a third truth, a higher truth, a kind of synthesis, an integration of those two other truths.
And you could end up with bread.
Exactly.
Or
something new. That's the idea.
Go ahead.
What usually happens, and I say this after 37 years experience working with divorcing couples, marrying couples, community cases, kids who commit crimes and their victims, large-scale international disputes, all of these things. What happens is that the things that we're talking about, that we're arguing about, that we're differing with each other over, are not the real issues. The real issues are beneath the surface. They're, am I appreciated? Am I being respected? Is somebody listening to my truth? Is there room for me in this conversation, in this relationship? And so we kind of pretend that the issue is which end of the toothpaste tube do you squeeze the toothpaste from? But the truth is, it's about individual differences and how we harmonize them. So in every marriage, there is endless dispute resolution. In every close relationship, every friendship, even between the two of you working together, there are potential areas of conflict. But what really is at stake underneath them is your ability to appreciate what each other brings to that relationship.
Does it become a decision to see that, or is that the mediator's job, is to help the each individual in the relationship to see that first step?
Well, the difficulty is, why is it that it's so hard to see it? And the answer is because we want it so badly, because we're so sensitive to it, because we're so vulnerable there, because this is about, am I being appreciated? Does somebody care about me? That's deep stuff. And so it is self-protective to find some artificial, external reason for our dispute. So we look for things to fight about, but those aren't the real things. So there's a kind of choice that's involved, which is the choice to be honest about what it is that you're really feeling. But it's deeper than choice, because oftentimes this is confusing even to us. We don't recognize it until the opportunity opens up for us to talk about what's really there.
So awareness and recognition is the first step.
Yes.
And then that's kind of, it almost sounds like on an interpersonal level or with a small group. But what about on the international stage or a larger group or an organization, a corporation.
A country.
Sure. Yeah. It's more complicated, but a lot of the issues are still the same. People are people, and conflicts are between people. So I've worked with national groups, corporations, workplaces. I've written a book called Resolving Conflicts at Work, among other books that I've written. And the difficulty is that you have now two elements that enter in. First, there's simply the addition of a lot more people, which complicates things. But still, issues of respect are important to cultures, to nation states. If you're treated disrespectfully, it creates international problems. But the second is, there's something else that arises, and that is the system. By system, I mean anything that turns in a circle. So there's an organizational system. There's a communication system. There is a financial system, a political system, a social system, but there's also a family system. So what the system is when I say that I would appreciate it if you would not squeeze the toothpaste from the middle of the tube, and my partner says, that's the way I want it, we don't just have an issue over the toothpaste tube, we have an issue over the system of the two of us being together. And the real question is, what does it mean to you when she squeezes the toothpaste from the middle of the tube? What does it mean to you when he asks you not to? And now we're beginning to talk about what's actually going on.
The toothpaste tube is really just a prop.
Yes, it's just a prop. Here's a concrete example. I've just made this up about the toothpaste tube, but it's a real example. Here's a real one. A couple that is having an argument, and they come in to talk to me about issues in their marriage. And I ask them how things are going. She says, well, just this morning, as we were leaving to come and see you, he left his dirty dish in the sink. And he goes, oh, he can't believe that she's upset about this. And says how, talks to her about how trivial this is. But meanwhile, she's thinking, this is not how trivial this is. This is how trivial you think I am. This is how trivial you think my needs are. So if I ask her the question, what does it mean to you when he leaves his dirty dish in the sink? She will say, it means he doesn't respect me. And if I ask, what does it mean that he doesn't respect you? She said, in this actual example, it means he doesn't love me. Now, we've got the dirty dish in the sink, and we've got respect and love. Which one is the real issue? Well, it's the deeper one. It's the issue of, does he love me? Because if he loved me, he would treat me respectfully. And if he treated me respectfully, he would understand that this creates extra work for me. Why? Because I believe that it's my job to clean the dish in the sink. Okay? That's the system, the marital system. And now what we have to do is first surface it, bring it out into the open where we can talk about it. And second, negotiate it from the point of view of each person having an interest that is true for them that needs to be recognized and acknowledged. What are we going to do now? And that's where it gets creative.
So in this rather simplified example, what is the resolution?
There isn't a single resolution. The resolution is really, in a sense, the conversation that they're about to have and the recognition that if he treats her respectfully and tells her that he loves her and shows it in various ways, she's going to be less upset about that single dirty dish in the sink.
I'm wondering how, as a mediator, because in this case, you were the mediator and you helped them, first of all, understand a few basic things and then start talking and sharing ideas, is how you as a mediator is different than a psychotherapist mm-hmm. or a marriage counselor.
Yeah. They're very similar on some levels because both of them are concerned with emotion. But the focus of the mediator, as opposed to the psychotherapist, is on problem solving. So what we really want to do is to create a conversation that's actually attempting to address what the problem is. But in order to get there, you have to figure out what the real problem is and figure out how to address that. So we have some areas of similarity, some overlap, some commonalities. But the reality is that every conflict has an emotional component on an international scale, as you can see, for example, taking place today with the revelations about Donald Trump Jr. And all of the conflicts that are taking place on a political level. There are high degrees of emotion that are involved here. The difficulty is you can't have an emotionally informed conversation within a political framework. Meaning, if you just talk about the dirty dish in the sink, you're not going to get to the underlying issues that are informing this for everybody. And those underlying issues have an emotional part to them. It doesn't mean that's the whole thing, but they have an emotional piece.
You know, I there's so many directions to go with this conversation.
Yeah.
And I definitely want to talk about the community, the case that you just mentioned about Donald Trump Jr., which has to do with the Russian hacking discussion going on. But before we get there, I want to go back even a little further, because I was thinking about this in advance of our talk here. that conflict seems almost baked into the human condition. And I was thinking, okay, where did a conflict start with me? Well, it was my big brother grabbing a toy I wanted. And we see that, of course, as parents or as young people ourselves, dealing with conflict just at that level. And how is there a natural way that sort of conflict gets handled? I don't know, maybe even in the evolutionary, as an evolutionary trait. It seems to me that the conflict got handled because he got to keep the toy. He was bigger and stronger. Is there a way that people would naturally handle conflicts that comes from our earliest ways we work with it?
The interesting part of the answer is that there are actually two fundamental ways in which we respond to conflicts that are hardwired in the human brain. And this is not just the human brain. You can go down through other species and discover exactly the same thing. So when your brother takes a toy away from you, that's no different from a squirrel taking a nut from another squirrel. So what gets triggered is two fundamental pathways in the human brain. The first we know as the fight or flight reflex. A signal is sent from the eye to the thalamus, which then goes to the amygdala, which is Greek for almond, and it just means there are two little places more or less in the center of your brain, low down, that do a threat detection. Is this something that is dangerous for me? And for your brother, the answer is yes. He's taken something that's important to you. That could be food, it could be clothing, it could be life itself. The pathway is the same. So what gets triggered is the release of adrenaline. A message is sent to your prefrontal cortex, which is the rational thinking part of your brain, saying, forget it, guys. We're shutting you down. We're hijacking your brain right now because we're getting ready for fight or flight or freeze. That's the first pathway, and we understand it pretty well. It turns out there's a second pathway that was developed by a group of researchers at UCLA who said, fight or flight makes a lot of evolutionary sense as a reflex, except if you're 8 months pregnant and you've got three kids hanging on you, or whatever your condition might happen to be. So they said there has to be a second pathway, and they discovered this pathway, and they called it tend and befriend. It's the pathway of collaboration, of working together, of commonality, of conflict resolution. So we've got two basic ways that we can approach it, and it turns out that they're linked with each other. So adrenaline is the neurotransmitter for the fight or flight reflex, and oxytocin is the neurotransmitter for the tend and befriend reflex. Oxytocin breaks down adrenaline. Adrenaline breaks down oxytocin. So they work more or less in opposition to each other. What releases oxytocin? Any act of generosity, any act of caring, touching, sex, kissing, watching a baby being born, nursing a baby, holding a baby, looking at the photograph of a baby releases oxytocin. And so one of the strategies in conflict resolution is to help people begin to let go of their fight or flight reflex and begin to move in the direction of tending and befriending.
This is fascinating. I do want to remind our listeners here at 88.5 KRFY, this is The Morning Show, and we have in the studios with us Kenneth Cloak. He's the author and international mediator, and we're talking about mediation as a way of looking at conflict and finding common ground and resolution. And you're also doing a talk tomorrow night at the Columbia Bank Building from 5:30 to 7 about this. And the talk is called A Conversation About Conflict. And as I said, this is fascinating. I do have one question about what you were talking about, the two pathways of brain development. And there are a lot of books out about this now. Richie Davidson has a book out called The Emotional Life of the Brain. I've been really looking into this quite a bit. And that whole idea of the flight and the fight and flight side, or the tend to befriend side that comes brings you closer to conflict resolution. How do you develop that if in a human being? And I think it does start before birth. I mean, before birth, probably in utero somewhat, and also then through a young child's life.
Sure. There are a series of ways. My daughter has twins, and her twin sons actually grew up in utero together and are highly evolved in terms of their ability to collaborate with each other. But there's another piece of it, which is that the fetus inside the womb actually exchanges cells with its mother, including brain cells, that help the mother decide to take care of the baby. So this is one small level on which this occurs. But basically, if I can put it slightly differently, every conflict creates a crossroads for us, a choice about which way we're going to go. And the first choice is, am I going to behave badly here and be reactive and jump right in and let my amygdala sort of do its fight or flight thing? Or am I going to try to figure out what's actually going wrong and see if I can fix it? Well, if you stay at the level of fight or flight, you never develop a set of skills that it turns out are important, not just for that, but for being in any relationship with anybody, for having a complex society, for developing science and art. Everything that we have developed as a culture, including this radio station, has come out of collaboration. And collaboration is basically a series of efforts to overcome the natural conflicts that divide us. If we stay at that level of saying, no, I'm right, and I'm the only one who is, the entire radio station disappears, along with virtually everything about our civilization. It just goes south.
So if someone understands this decision and this choice, or the crossroad, as you say, what it would be a first thought when they come up against a conflict or a feeling of, I'm going to stand my ground kind of thing, what would be a good first thought?
I think the important first thought is, what exactly is the problem? Because if we identify the problem as a person, then what's going to happen is we're going to be antagonistic to that person. But if we can define the problem as an it instead of as a you, then we can begin to do something about it together. Here's a second thought. There's a chart in one of my books that shows how to do this. The very first word out of our mouths when we're in conflict and the other person is there is generally you, as in you did this or you are this. But if we think about how to shift that pronoun and what happens when we use that pronoun, we discover that a series of things are taking place. The word, if you use the word you in a negative way, that takes the form of an accusation. And the natural response to an accusation, whether it's a nation state, the leaders of Germany or China or Russia, or whoever it might happen to be, your partner, the natural response will be, no, I'm not, and you're something else. Defense and counterattack. That's fight or flight, translated to the level of language. But if instead we say, can we define the problem as an it, or even as an I, or as a we, you shift the focus in a completely different direction. So fundamentally, all of conflict resolution is about problem solving. And what we're looking at is, what's the best way of solving a problem? And the first thing to do is to figure out that the problem isn't really the other person. It may be their behavior. But then we can focus on the behavior that we don't like instead of labeling them as being a bad person.
And I really think that is a lot of what's going on in the national discussion right now. Part of what's polarizing us is that people are identifying, you know, us versus them, or identifying, you know, the people that may have voted for Trump versus the people that may have voted for Clinton. And those groups are addressing each other as you rather than, you know, I disagree with your decision. That doesn't mean you're necessarily a bad person because you took a different tack in that election. Is that, does that translate out that way?
Yes, I think that's right. In the interview that you did with me in the Sandpoint magazine, yes. The summer issue, just to put in a plug for that.
Yeah, and, well, Trish Gannon actually did the interview in the Sandpoint magazine.
Yes.
Yeah.
Basically, there's a short little piece about this, which is that politics is basically problem solving. So it's not that disagreements are bad. The disagreements are actually very good. They look at different futures. In order to have a political conflict, you have to have three things, three fundamental things. First, there has to be diversity, meaning people have to have different views of what's politically correct. If they agree with each other, there's no conflict. Second, there has to be inequality in terms of whose ideas get implemented and whose don't. And third, most important from our purposes as conflict resolvers, is there has to be a win-lose adversarial process for deciding whose political ideas get implemented and whose don't. And that's where the problem comes in. So nobody's making bread. But out of the conversation between people who disagree with each other comes the possibility for realizing there's a higher order of solution that we could get to if we could just talk to each other in realistic terms about this. This isn't just an abstract thing. For example, you mentioned Mediators Beyond Borders before, an organization that I founded 10 years ago. For the last several years, a group of us have been going to Athens training Greek mediators in how to conduct dialogues between immigrants and Greek citizens. And these are intense political conversations with people who are very much opposed to each other. But out of these,
and Greece has really been overrun with immigration, immigrants coming from the Middle East.
Yeah. Worse mm-hmm. than anywhere else yeah. in Europe. And so it's a very touchy topic, and people are very hot under the collar about this. And yet what we have discovered, having done this numerous times with real dialogues, not just training people in how to do them, but actually conducting them, is that it is possible for people together to recognize each other as fellow human beings, to see that they have a problem, and to figure out how together they're going to solve it. And that's the thing that makes it important. So we have a series of problems in this country, and we have to figure out how to solve them. But if we say, I'm not talking to this one and I refuse to talk to that one, which is a part of the political culture, it makes you sound tough and strong to be able to say, for example, we've tried everything with North Korea. But the one thing that we haven't tried is actually sitting down together and talking about how to solve this problem. And that, in part, is what is fueling it. So it's not that coming together means you have to reach agreements with each other. There are lots and lots of cases where people will not agree, but they no longer will assume that the other person is less than human. They'll no longer demonize them or treat them as evil. They will realize that they're a fellow human being and they need to be respected.
Does that even play into, you used the North Korea example, and is it Kim Jong, the leader there? He's being demonized in the West, and it kind of seems like maybe he has it coming because of the way he's dealing with not his own people and the whole escalation in their nuclear capability there. Sometimes it seems like it does come down to just a right and wrong matter, that the other side is simply wrong and should be opposed.
There, oftentimes it looks right and wrong, but as soon as you get into it, you discover that what is right for one turns out to be wrong for the other, mostly because of the fact that they haven't really spoken to each other. They haven't come to terms with each other. So the real question that I like to think about is, whatever it is that you do internationally, think about what it would mean if you did that in your family. If you had an argument with your spouse or your kids, how would you handle it? Nuclear weapons, mm-hmm. Economic sanctions. Well, those are things that actually are going to provoke worse conflicts. So we look at it from our point of view and think, how could they be responding this way? But the truth is, it's a system that turns in a circle. And what we do provokes them to do what they do, which provokes us to do what we do. And that's the way escalation works. Mm-hmm. So we have to figure out ways of moving that in a different direction.
So what you're saying is, as we in the West look at North Korea and see their escalating missile testing and nuclear testing, we're seeing a portion of what's really going on for them. And it's through sitting down and talking that you start, they would also see what we see, because we're talking, and we would see what they're seeing. And I see it as a circle also. And it's without that conversation, we'll say, nothing changes.
Well, we used to be able to think that we were living in a world where one could be right and the other could be totally wrong, and that would be okay. But the world's too small to do that anymore. What are the options in terms of North Korea? Bombing them? Well, they're immediately going to send nuclear weapons to Japan and South Korea and blow Tokyo off the map, or whatever it is they're going to do. That's just not a useful way of solving the problem. Millions of people could die in the event that something like that took place. And we're edging closer to it without even thinking about it. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that that everything that everybody does is okay. That's not the point. We can have agreements and disagreements. We can say, from our point of view, what you're doing is harmful, and they can say the same to us. But what's most important is that, as a species that occupies the planet, we can't any longer rely on military force to fundamentally solve problems. And we can't rely on litigation before the International Court of Justice to solve problems. We have to figure out how to solve them at a much more collaborative level. This is our evolution as a species into this tend and befriend type of approach.
You want to remind our listeners that this is the 88.5 KRFY morning show with hosts Chris and Susie, and we're speaking this morning with Kenneth Cloak. He's a part-time resident of Hope, but he's the founder of the Center for Dispute Resolution and also the Mediators Beyond Borders. Ken, you're going to be talking tomorrow. That's Thursday, 5:30 to 7 p.m. at the on a topic called A Conversation About Conflict. Everybody's invited. It's at the Columbia Bank Community Room. It's actually hosted by KRFY and Sandpoint Magazine. One of the things that I think you're going to address there, and I'm hoping you'll be able to address there, is talking about the ways that groups, communities deal with disputes and conflicts. And as you just described it, now it's often a political question, right? The county commissioners, or the city council, or the school board have to weigh out a bunch of factors in making a decision, and there's two sides involved. And it seems like you in these types of situations, you end up with a winner, quote unquote. And which means you also have a loser. And I'm just wondering, are there ways that you can advise local decision makers like our city council or our commissioners to weigh things out when they're in the middle of a dispute to come to an equitable decision?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. This is what in negotiation language is called a zero-sum game, meaning if there's 10 and you get 7, I get 3. And if you get 6, I get 4. So there's a competition automatically between the two of us, just as between you and your brother. That your assumption was that was a zero-sum game. He took your toy, you had one fewer toys, and he had one more. But there's a different approach, which is to look for ways of turning that in the direction of something where everybody can win. And what the formality of that, the terminology for it is an interest-based solution. So we ask, what does the toy mean to you? Why are you interested in that toy? What do you get from playing with it? Or for communities, why is this issue important to you? Why do you care so deeply about it? My mediation partner, Joan Goldsmith, and I just worked in a city in Arkansas with the members of the city council, the mayor, the chief of police, the leaders of all the major environmental groups within the city. And we brought all of them together, trained representatives of everybody in dialogue techniques, and then we had a dialogue about the future of this community in which there was a dam, and the environmental groups wanted the dam destroyed, and many of the people in the city council wanted the dam kept. So which one is right? Should there be a dam or should there not be a dam? In the conversation, what happened is the man who was on the city council said, the reason I want a dam is because when I was young, my father and I used to go and fish there. And the guy who is the head of the environmental organization said, oh, that's really interesting, because when I was young, my father and I used to go to the river and fish there. Is it possible to have a river and a dam? And what would that look like? And how could you preserve what the reasons are for wanting either a dam or a river? So if it is cold in this room right now, we can turn on the heat, which you won't like, or turn on the air conditioning, which I won't like. But if we ask, why do we want the heat or the air conditioning on? I'm cold and you're hot. So how about if we address those issues? I can put on a jacket. You can take off a shirt, and we can both be happy in the same environment. In other words, nobody has to lose in order for one person to get what they really are interested in.
So it sounds like the first step is really talking, hearing common, finding that common problem to solve together. You become partners in problem solving.
Exactly right.
So on the larger scale, the mediators beyond borders in the big world to calm some of the fears that are out there right now. I think the world, because there is so much conflict and division and things like that, how do you find these places? Do you have to be invited to come in, or do you kind of identify them as a group of mediators without borders or beyond borders and say, you know, we could help that situation, and go in and offer it?
Usually we're invited in, but sometimes it's a little bit of the second as well. So, for example, we've had a project in Rwanda. And if you think about right and wrong, if you're a Hutu, Tutsis are wrong. And if you're a Tutsi, Hutus are wrong. And this whole idea about a group of people being right or wrong just doesn't make any sense. So what we have to do instead is figure out exactly, as you're saying, how to create the questions that will help people listen to each other. Or another example is we worked in a refugee camp in Ghana with child soldiers. These are kids 8, 9, 10 years old who are recruited into murder, basically. And of course, there are very good reasons for people to murder each other. There always are. But there are even better reasons for not doing that if you can solve your problems in some intelligent way. And everybody who uses violence, everybody involved in conflict has some problem that they're trying to solve somehow. So another example right now is I'm with a group of people who are working in Cambodia. And in Cambodia, after the Khmer Rouge, all of the records for sort of who owned what piece of land were destroyed. So nobody knows really where, who owns what piece of land and who doesn't. And now the Chinese are coming in and developers are coming in and the government officials are claiming that they own land that they had nothing to do with. So one way of doing it is to go to court and have a judge decide, okay, you own this piece of land and you own that piece of land. But how are they going to decide that? And who says that the judge is going to be free of corruption? So instead, there's a different approach, which is to get the communities to come together to agree on the criteria for deciding who owns a piece of land, regardless of whatever the land may happen to be. And that's a consensus-building process that has to do with everybody coming forward with their stories and listening to their stories and trying to figure out how do we find what's in common between them, exactly as you're saying. And it's the same in any relationship.
The one question I have when I take a look at kind of the landscape that we work in now in the internet age is how social media is playing into the whole question of conflict, because it seems like there is a conflict expressed in these Facebook dialogues that you see where people are just at each other in a way that's, You wouldn't see if they were in the room together. Can you speak to that? What social media is doing to the whole way people are dealing with conflict now?
Yeah, it's made it much easier for people to flame at each other, to troll each other, to behave badly towards each other.
Behave badly is the word.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So in any family, when somebody's upset, they may feel like saying that or doing that, but they know that there's a relationship there and that they'll damage their relationship with that person if they actually say this. And so therefore, they are encouraged to develop higher order skills in order to preserve what's useful and important to them in that relationship. That has disappeared in a lot of social media. And I think we have to figure out ways of bringing that back together, because we are one human family, truthfully, and we don't behave that way.
Yeah, and it seems, especially when these commenters can stay anonymous, the tenor is even worse, right? Because they know, well, I can take on any persona I want. You wonder if this is people letting their real feelings out, that when they want to behave better, they won't let out.
Groups of mediations that I've done are mediations between kids who commit crimes and their victims. Young kids who commit crimes, and they come face to face with the person who they hurt, who they never imagined before as a real human being. And just seeing that person in their presence already shifts their attitude towards them, because we're now in the same room together. And they can see them, that this is a real human being. And then you ask that person to say, what did it feel like to have your car broken into and all your stuff stolen by him? Mm-hmm. Tell him how you felt about that. And this gives the kid an opportunity to actually see that the crime they committed was one that came out of a lack of understanding that there's somebody else out there who's going to be hurt by what they did. And when they see that and experience it firsthand, it has a real impact on them.
You're really opening up that second part of the brain pathway. And what was I call it the compassionate side, but it had a it gets flooded with the chemical.
Oxytocin.
Oxytocin.
Yeah.
So you're flooding it with oxytocin. So you've made it mandatory in this way for them to open up to the compassionate side of themselves. You see someone cry, it almost makes you cry. You've opened that up. I'd like to make a proposal that the Congress, the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C., and the Senate meditate together before they go to session. And they meditate every day, because I've heard that also the Buddha brain is that side of the brain, and it starts developing that more. Maybe our culture has developed the first side, the fight and flight side, so well. The other side needs a little boost.
Meditation can definitely help. Mostly it gives you a sense of self-awareness, so you experience what it feels like to be kind and compassionate to another person, and what it feels like when you're angry and hostile towards them. And the second one is not pleasant. But a lot of people just live in that kind of space. So we need to strengthen that muscle. And that's one way of doing it. Another way is to just look for small ways of being kind to other people. There's a movement even around random acts of kindness. Paying for somebody's toll on a toll road is something that happens fairly often now in the San Francisco Bay Area, where somebody will just say, here's for the person behind me.
It's funny, because I just saw a story yesterday about, I don't even know where it was, but it was a fast food place, and somebody said, hey, I want to pay for the person behind me. And that got carried on 160 times, and it was hours that everybody was paying for the person behind them. And it was just, I thought, wow, that is remarkable. If we could unleash that spirit across, the whole country, just think how much more positive everything would be. You know, we're going to run out of time here very shortly. Again, Ken, you are speaking tomorrow, 5:30 p.m. at the community room in the Columbia Bank Building, about a conversation about conflict. The entire public is invited to come. We've also invited a lot of personal invitations to a lot of community leaders, the city council, commissioners, some of the school board folks, hoping they'll come to hear about constructive ways to deal with disputes. I was wondering, as kind of a last question, what led you into a field where you deal with people that are having arguments and disputes every day?
Mm-hmm. It was my own conflicts, of course. my lack of understanding of what I could do that could make a difference. And then secondly, the experience of frustration at being a judge and not being able to really dig down deep enough into what the actual problem was. And a third part of it was just a concern about war and how destructive all of this is. Human lives just get completely destroyed. And for what in the end? And if it weren't necessary to do that, how would you build a kind of society where people could develop a different set of skills?
And it starts right in the family, and it spreads out to homeowners associations, to communities, then to countries.
Exactly.
Even. Do you do training for people?
I do.
That want to learn mediation techniques?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
Is that part of what you do through the Center for Dispute Resolution?
Yes.
If people wanted to learn more about that, how would
they
do that?
Sure. They could go to my website, which is www.kennethcloak.com. And I have trainings that I do really around the world.
Mm-hmm. Great.
I was just thinking about a handshake. When you actually reach your hand out and touch someone, that right there is a connection.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you might be at odds, but you start that way. So that gives you a platform of connection.
Here's a way of doing it. A ritual I think of as any act that you invest with meaning and then perform. So if you say to someone, would you be willing, as a symbol of your willingness to talk about these issues, to shake hands with each other?
So consciously, intentionally, not
right.
Just habitually.
Right.
Exactly. Well, this has been very fascinating. Thank you. I think the event tomorrow night at the Columbia Bank Building at 5:30 is a real opportunity, and we're very grateful that you came in, and thanks again.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Yeah.
And with that, we got,
5 minutes. I have a song queued up. I do want to remind our listeners that right after Bird Note, there you will hear a song, and it's Guy Clark's Homegrown Tomatoes. It will take us right into my next interview with Gaia Swinford from the Bonner County Gardening Association.
Which will be about 9:05, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And right now, we're going to go out of our morning show, and I'll do a little bit of community calendar after my interview with Gaia.
Okay.
We're going to go out with a Christine McVie Fleetwood Mac song, and it is called Dreams. And the reason we're hearing this song is Christine McVie was born on this day in 1943. She's from Fleetwood Mac.
And Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah.
Yep.
Here's the famous song, Dreams. We'll be right back. Stay with us. There'll be another interview about 9:05.
Bye now.
Bye.